Bertie talks to the leader in association with the Guardian Voluntary Sector Network and becauseitsgood.org.
Hello, I'm Bertie Boredon. I've been working in the not-for-profit sector for over 10 years. In this podcast, I talk to chief executives, managers and innovators of the UK voluntary sector. I ask them about their role, their motivation and the challenges they're facing. Welcome to Talk to the Leader. My guest could have been a professional football player. He played for Epping Forest for a number of seasons. He played for Bath and Kent University football clubs and for Canterbury City, but had to stop football after an injury. He's got 11 winner medals. He's a fan of Tottenham, a huge fan of Bruce Springsteen and of Napoleon. He worked for the Royal National Institute for the Blind for 15 years, where he was director of community services. In 2004, he joined the Stroke Association. My guest is John Barrick, CEO of the Stroke Association. Hello, John.
Good morning.
I have to confess, I know very little about football. I should know more about Napoleon, but before we talk about that, could you tell us a bit more about the work of the Stroke Association?
Well, the Stroke Association is the leading charity concerned with stroke here in the UK. We are concerned about prevention, and we're doing a lot around trying to prevent strokes. We fund research. In fact, we've been the major funder of stroke research for the last 20 years. And we're also very much into the idea of life after stroke. And we provide around about 400 services under contract to the NHS, helping families whose lives have been shattered by stroke. In addition to that, we have around about 400 stroke clubs that are affiliated to the organisation. So we're really very much in contact with stroke survivors and their families.
Yeah, so you've worked in a charity sector for quite a long time, but do you remember the very first time you did something for a charity?
Well, interestingly, my very first idea of people getting together to try and change things for the better was when I was a young child. And on the estate where I lived, all of the people had gathered together in a sort of form of early social enterprise where they had a club where people would put money into it to enhance their savings. But if a family got into difficulty, they could also borrow money from that. And that was really a very early introduction to me as a child around the way that people could club together to help themselves and help their neighbours and have a sense of community and make life better. So that would be my earliest memory, really, of it's not so much charitable work, but people having a sense of social enterprise to make things better.
Is that why you then joined the RNIB?
Yes, I mean, I think that within my family, there's always been disability. So I've grown up with disability. But there's also been a huge desire in me to change the world for the better. So before RNIB, I actually worked in homelessness and I've worked in anti-poverty work. But when I got that job at RNIB, I felt like I was coming home, really, working in an area where I really could contribute something.
So you've really worked in the charity sector all your working life so far?
Well, no, because I've worked in the private sector. I worked for the Central Civil Service, also for local government in homelessness. And I've also worked in the DHSS when a whole benefits area and so on. So I've really worked in all sectors, yeah. And I've drawn a little bit from each of them.
Mm-hmm. You must have seen lots of change in the sector since you worked there.
Yes, I mean, I think it's often commented upon about the professionalism of the sector. But sometimes I think that people who used to say the sector's not professional maybe had never really engaged with the sector. I think that we are more sophisticated now. And certainly we're a much bigger employer within the economy. But there are some distinguishing features for me about the voluntary sector that separated off from the other sectors. And one of those, of course, would be the absolute passion that so many people bring to their work and the drive that people have to make a better world, which is what attracts them to the sector in the first place.
After RNIB, you joined the Stroke Association. Do you remember your very first day as chief executive?
I can remember that day, yes. One of the things that struck me when I went into the office was just how friendly everybody was and how open. And I think there was a bit of a sense of trepidation from some people that a new CEO was starting. But there was that friendliness. And a tip that I would give to everybody who's going into a senior management role in the voluntary sector is to read a book called The First 90 Days, which is produced by Harvard Business School, which actually gives you lots of tools about how to analyse the culture and what the organisation is like. And I certainly used that book in my first 90 days. And that's my really abiding memory of the first day, was the friendliness, but also the trepidation of some people.
So that was 7 years ago. What have been the biggest changes you witnessed in the past 7 years?
Well, I mean, it's been a fantastic march forward in terms of stroke care in this country. As an organisation, we have trebled in size almost. We have gone from 330 staff to over 800 now. We've seen four stroke strategies introduced, one in each of the countries of the UK. We've seen TV advertising to actually bring the reality of stroke symptoms home to people, and that they need to dial 999, that stroke is a medical emergency. We're seeing stroke improvements happening in care all over the UK. And that's all fantastic. And we've also seen a lot more investment into long-term support and care for stroke survivors and their families. So all of those things are terrific. And we are now putting more money into research, because stroke's going to become the world's second biggest killer over the next 20 years. And it is the number one cause of long-term serious disability. And it amazed me 7 years ago, and it still amazes me now, that so little money is put into stroke research to find those cures and treatments that will mean that people won't suffer the devastating effects of stroke.
One of the big changes that we've witnessed in our society in the past few years is digital. And I know you've got your own website, which you set up a few years ago. The Stroke Association have obviously a large website with information. You've got a podcast on there. You've got also an online community. To which extent do you feel the internet, and more recently social media or social web, have changed the way you operate?
Well, it has. And it's very interesting that we're having to upgrade our website now so that it's much more accessible to people who are using smartphones, because the trend is for people under 25 to do most of their access of web material via their smartphones now. So there's things that we have to do as an organisation. But there are also huge opportunities in different ways in terms of digital activity. I'll give you two examples. One of the effects of stroke for around about a third of people is that they get aphasia, which is an inability to talk or communicate in the way that they did before their stroke. Well, now you can begin to, even on an iPhone, you can download speech substitution software, which enables you to have a little machine that can actually say phrases and say things for you, which enables many people who have found it incredibly difficult to engage. They have a tool now that they can use when they go out and begin to engage again. Another example, something we're working on, is self-management tool, which is, if you have a stroke and you want to know about how to do various things, and you want to know about AIDS products, equipment, you want to know about how you can alter your home and so on, we can put a whole self-management package together now that can actually be dovetailed towards the individual and so on. And we're working on that. And that can go on something like an iPad, that can be connected to the cloud, which will enable us to upgrade all of the little films, all of the information and so on that's on that, and also enable the person to bring down other information for them. So the big drive that we've got to help people to self-manage their condition can really be enhanced by these sorts of digital processes. And I think that those things are going to be very, very helpful over the years.
Well, that's very impressive, because what I've witnessed more in the sector is many charities are still using the web just as a fundraising tool, and not many charities have realized it's actually a fantastic tool to deliver service. And clearly you've done all of that.
Well, we have to put investment into these things, and we're working with a number of universities who have psychologists who are helping us with how you would put these sorts of programs and processes together so that they're easily utilized by people and so on. So there's a lot has to go into it, but certainly in terms of the resource of having a one-on-one person helping people, or giving them the ability to use an iPad and come to an individual when they don't understand or they need some really practical physical based help, it opens up the possibility of helping literally hundreds of thousands of people as opposed to just a number of people at a particular point in time.
And do you offer training to your clients or beneficiaries to use those tools?
Well, it's still in development at the moment, so these are all things that we'll have to think about. But as I say, we're looking beyond just the web to actually look at how we can put digital technologies in the hands of stroke survivors so that they can begin to have more independence and actually grab hold of their own lives.
Do you use Twitter yourself?
No, I don't.
Most of the chief executives I've met for this podcast told me about the impact of the recession, which is big in the sector. Have you been affected by the recession?
Yes, we are. And I think that looking across the sector, all charities are being affected by the recession, in the sense that donors are maybe not able to be as generous as they were in the past. And we've got this tremendous assault on public expenditure, which is affecting many charities, particularly those of us who have contracts where we're having to try and be more accommodating to the needs of the commissioners in terms of the money that they've got. So these are worrying times. I think that we've grown so much over the last few years that we will sustain ourselves through all this. But I do fear that there are many charities doing great work who are going to find it very, very difficult to sustain themselves.
And at the same time, we're hearing about the big society. Do you think there will be some opportunities for the Stroke Association?
Well, yes, there will be opportunities, but I do think that in many ways, charities were actually doing the big society idea anyway. This notion that citizens can get involved in actually making a better world, surely that's what many voluntary sector organisations were all about anyway. And I think the big issue for us is the government really committed to big society? Because big society actually requires some financing. It can't all be done through voluntarism. Even voluntarism requires resource to recruit people, to train people, to manage people, to make sure the adequate safeguards are in place and so on and so forth. And looking around, the people who we're very close to, stroke survivors, there is an assault on the possibilities of life for many of those people at the moment, with benefit cuts, with big cuts to social care, the turmoil inside the reorganisation of the NHS is meaning that there's uncertainty about how long-term support may be managed and provided in the future. So in a way, we need the government to really commit to the big society and understand that many of their policies in all sorts of areas are impacting upon the possibility of the Speak Society being successful. And, you know, our job is to give a voice to the fragmented people who are voiceless at the moment without us. And I think we do have to be courageous and say the Big Society isn't going to work unless there's some investment in it from government.
But I'm not sure the government is hearing that.
Well, I think that many of us are actually working together. The Stroke Association is involved in a number of coalitions, whether it's the Care and Support Alliance that's concerned about social care, whether it's the Hardest Hit campaign with many organisations concerned about welfare benefits and the changes that are going on there. There's the Richmond Group and National Voices who are concerned about NHS reforms and how that's going. We are actually working very much together, talking about these things and putting our points of view to the ministers behind the scenes and making sure that they're aware that, you know, we have concerns about many of these things.
You've already mentioned some of your innovative digital projects, but you're a fairly large charity. The Stroke Association has an income of around, I think, 20 million.
It's 32 million.
32 million. Yeah. Big increase since last financial year. You've mentioned around 800 staff. How do you bring innovation in your organisation?
Well, without going into too much detail, we do have a number of processes for that. We have a thing called Ideas Interaction, where anybody in the organisation can actually put forward ideas or project proposals. Those things need to be worked up and people actually bring them there. But of course, we're very much in contact with stroke survivors as well. And I think that we learn huge amounts every day from stroke survivors who talk about the things that are affecting them and the things that help them to actually get round issues that they're dealing with. So there's a huge amount of innovation that flows out of that. I think another way that we have innovation is that we try and work collaboratively with many other organisations and with the medics and social care people. So, for example, we have brought together a coalition of 26 organisations, the stroke consultants, the nurses, the stroke therapists and so on. And we have an annual conference every year, which brings all of the people together in the multidisciplinary team who are working with stroke. And there's lots of research being shown. But people, through getting together, find new ideas, new solutions, new ways of actually addressing things. And it's very exciting to be at the heart of all of those things. And, you know, the passion that is there inside our organisation and inside the volunteers and inside often the families of stroke survivors to actually make things better, that constantly throws up new forms of ideas and innovation.
And are there any big opportunities you regret to have missed or were too late to grab?
I think there are always opportunities that you think you've missed. I suppose there's been opportunities at times for us to merge with some other organisations, but it didn't happen for one or other reason. I think those are the major things that come to my mind. I think the biggest opportunity that we're probably missing is that we're not investing enough into research, into stroke and stroke care. As I say, stroke's going to become the world's second biggest killer within the next 20 years, and the time to do that research is now.
What do you see as your main challenges in the next few years?
Well, obviously there's the financial challenges, making sure that we maintain the wherewithal to keep all of the services going, to keep the spend going into research and the spend into prevention. We're going to be doing a lot of work next year in terms of trying to raise the profile of the Stroke Association. So that's going to be difficult in, you know, difficult financial times. But we really do want to push forward this research concept. So, We've got the Princess Margaret Fund, which is a big campaign to raise more money for stroke research, and we'll be pushing that a lot more over the next 12 months.
Being French, in case you haven't noticed, I must ask about your passion for Napoleon. What do you find interesting about this period of the French history?
Well, I think it's the concept of liberty, equality, fraternity. And it's that whole concept of citizenry beginning to come through in Europe for the first time, from an aristocratic way of running things to the notion that people can begin to seize their own destiny. So it's those elements that I'm interested in, and I'm interested in the liberation really of thought that occurred around that time, and so on.
Okay, so my final question: if you are not chief executive of the Stroke Association and couldn't be Bruce Springsteen, what would you do?
Well, I think I'd probably be enjoying some role in a service provider organisation of some sort, where I felt that I was making a contribution to making life better for someone.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bertie.
That was Talk to the Leader with Bertie Boroydon. To find out more about this podcast and how to subscribe, go to nfp.org.uk.